Hello and welcome to Behind the News, the last show of 2016. My name is Doug Henwood. Today we'll hear from Zahra Ballou about Donald Trump and the spreading Islamophobia in the right wing of the body politic. And Andrew Coburn takes the measure of the spreading Russophobia in the left wing of the body politic. Apologies for the sound quality on my end of today's two interviews. I'm away for the holidays and there were some technical challenges. First, the increasing threats to Muslim Americans and how we could resist them. Donald Trump has been making very nasty promises to institute, or more exactly reinstitute, since there was a precedent during the Bush years, a registry of Muslims in the U.S. Details, as is usual with Trump, are scarce. But also, as usual with Trump, the likelihood of state action is only one part of the threat. The other is how he's encouraged private action, in this case harassment and worse of Muslims in the streets and subways, and vandalism against mosques. It's all highly reminiscent of the period just after 9/11. Zahra Ballou will say in the interview that we're about to listen to that things are worse now than they were 15 years ago. I'm not so sure about that. For one thing, I think there's more willingness and capacity to fight back now, but there's not a whole lot of point in arguing about the comparison. Both are bad, and things now have taken a serious turn for the worse. Here's Zahra Ballou, a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations, to tell us what's going on and how it can be fought. We've heard a lot from Donald Trump about establishing some sort of Muslim registry, but do we have any sense of what he means, any kind of detail by this?
The best that we can look at is what has been done in the past and then assume that it could be updated based on technology. It could be expanded based on his disregard for civil liberties. And so it's difficult to say with certainty, but there is concern that he will attempt to go forward.
And there was a Bush-era thing called, I believe, NSEERS, right?
Right.
What was that all about?
Yeah, so that's actually the looking back at the past that we're concerned about. And so after 9/11, the Bush administration instituted a program called the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System. And what it essentially required people to do was that non-citizen males over the age of 16 from a number of countries, all except North Korea being...
We lost the audio there briefly, but what Zahra Ballou was saying was that non-citizens from mostly Muslim-majority countries, with the exception of North Korea and most of those Arab, were required to register in person at Immigration and Naturalization Service offices.
What we've heard and what we saw back then from people who were subject to the process was that they had to go in for interviews, they had to get fingerprinted. It was an invasive and humiliating process. Over 100,000 people registered through the program, of which about 10% were deported for a variety of things. And what I remember as a young activist then is men lining up outside of INS buildings and some of them not coming out. And what was most fearful was not knowing who would come out and who wouldn't. Now, of course, for those that aren't offended by just the sheer ridiculousness of that and how counter it runs to our values to target people from certain countries for special or heightened restrictions when they haven't had any criminal activity or background, maybe what they will be compelled by is that not a single terrorism conviction was obtained through any of this. And so when we think about what's wrong with programs like this, not only are they counter to our values, they're ineffective.
I imagine that people like Trump are deriving some sort of vindication in their own minds from events like the Christmas market massacre in Germany the other day, in which a guy hijacked a truck and ran into a crowd of shoppers. They imagine that there's some enormous cadre of sleeper terrorists about to be aroused at any moment now. But that makes me wonder, is Europe doing anything remotely like what NSEERS was or Trump is likely to do?
Some days I'm grateful that I don't do this work in Europe. As bad as anti-Muslim sentiment may be in the United States, sometimes it does feel much worse in Europe, right? The demographic situation there is different. The most obvious difference we point out is the ghettoization of recent immigrant communities, right? And so they're not supported in integration efforts. The other thing is that the rhetoric is horrendous in Europe, right? The anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-refugee rhetoric, the white supremacist hate crimes, the targeting of different people practicing their faith, right? One example of minorities being targeted that got a lot of attention a few months ago was the attempt at a burkini ban in parts of France. And then, of course, attempts to counter violent extremism through a entirely religious lens, targeting just members of minority communities as opposed to white supremacists and others, is something that we saw first happen in Europe. And so there are worse problems there. And unfortunately, the ineffective strategies that are being talked about in the United States are attempting to be implemented in Europe.
Well, it's not often that one derives some kind of comfort from being American, but I guess this is one instance where maybe it's not so bad. Now, 100,000 men had to register during the Bush era. As you said, about 10% were deported. What reasons were given for these deportations, if any?
It was a variety of things, right? So people with minor mistakes in their immigration applications, people who had overstayed their visas and thought that by walking in to the registration day that they would receive some mercy, right, because they were willfully reporting. And then there were others who did things like simply miss their registration dates because they didn't know that they needed to go in and register because they had things like a car accident or a job interview. And so it was a variety of things, none of which were terrorist related.
And those who were deported, was any consideration given to how welcome they might be on their return, how they might be treated?
I think it depended on the situations, but yes, one of the biggest problems with deportations is that very often the United States doesn't care where it's sending them back. And that is unfortunate, right? Like, we're looking out for our self-interest when we send someone back, and in some cases we send them back to places and situations that are worse.
Thinking back to 9/11, I remember the political environment, the psycho-political environment of those days was just utterly paranoid and freaked out. We're not experiencing anything like that now. What kind of resistance was capable of organizing in those days, you know, 10, 15 years ago? The political environment seemed more difficult to organize any kind of resistance. Was there any that went on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not sure that I would agree that it was worse back then, right? When we look at anti-Muslim sentiment, it's worse today in 2015 and 2016 than it was in the fall of 2001. And whether we liked or agreed with George W. Bush, which I think most of us did not, it's worth noting that his rhetoric was a lot more gentler. Well, a lot gentler and more unifying than what we're seeing today. Now, having a Republican president calling for unity, saying things like we are not at war with Islam, was important, at least in protecting against hate crimes and hate incidents, right? And so that's very different today. We have a president-elect who runs his mouth in the middle of the night on Twitter and says horrendous things, which then embolden people who are saying, well, government policy is bad, but it doesn't go far enough. Let me target the Muslims in my community. Now, in terms of the resistance, it's often been challenging because targeted communities are afraid, and justifiably so. And so for many of us who are activists from these targeted communities, we're helping people learn what their rights are. We're helping them understand the various tools that are available for resisting. And then we're working with them to say, look, we're going to protest. We're going to write petitions. We're going to meet with our elected officials. Many have talked about this as an inside-outside strategy. We need people inside meeting with our elected officials, talking to them, holding strong to principles, right? So not compromising, but going in and having the conversation. And then others protesting outside the buildings, right? Like holding up the signs, rallying in the streets. We need both.
What tools are available to people who are not members of these marginalized targeted communities to aid in the resistance? You know, we look on appalled, feeling powerless. Is there something concrete we could actually do?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I've appreciated in the weeks since the election, seeing allied communities step forward with things like, hey, we will wear safety pins to communicate our solidarity, or if there's a Muslim registry, we will be sure to register with you. In terms of what we can do in the interim, I would say a few things. One, get to know your Muslim neighbors, get to know your undocumented neighbors, get to know your Black and Latino neighbors, right? And of course, keep in mind that many of these designations cut across communities. There are Black Muslims, there are undocumented Muslims, right? There are Black LGBT individuals from the Muslim community, and so on. So the cross-sectionality is important to remember. Get to know people that are different from yourself so that you can understand what their immediate needs are. Post 9/11, I still remember our neighbors offering to go grocery shopping for my mom out of concern that maybe she wasn't feeling safe going outside as a visible Muslim woman. So get to know your neighbors from different communities. Stop and interrupt racist rhetoric when you hear it. Many times people in allied communities are more likely to hear that racist rhetoric than I am. It's not common, at least in my life situation, for someone to come up to me and call me a towel head. Do I imagine that people who are not Muslim may come across that rhetoric more than me? Yeah. So interrupt that rhetoric, because it is that kind of hate and bigotry that then gives way to problematic policies. And then should and when something come down from Donald Trump, be ready to register, to protest, to help the impacted communities resist.
And I've heard some reaction to this impulse to register oneself, even though not Muslim, saying that's just either not practical or not helpful. What do you think of that? Is it even possible to register? These seem like you're, it's an invitation-only list. It's not a matter of volunteering.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because we don't know what the list will look like, right? Last time you had to walk yourself into an INS building on a certain day, depending on certain criteria. So if it comes down exactly that way, then for sure, registering is going to be impossible. But the sentiment can be challenged into something productive. One of the things I did as a young activist back then was document people going in and out of the building so we could know who wasn't coming out. So there will be ways like that to get close to the program and assist people. Now, if it's something where you turn on your phone and they get the data from Facebook, for sure, Doug might not be able to register in place of Muhammad, but Doug may be able to reach out and make sure that Muhammad feels safe, that if something happens to Muhammad, that there's a legal defense fund, right? And so there are different ways that this is going to manifest. I am choosing to be positive this morning and appreciate the solidarity of people that are saying that they will register with us and thinking about how we can use that to challenge into resistance.
Abusuka Zarabalu, who is the executive director of the CARE office in the Bay Area. So what kind of legal challenges were mounted to the NCRS program back during the Bush days?
People challenged it in different ways. There was resistance, right? So there were people that were protesting. There were people that were lobbying up until just a couple of weeks ago, and I'll talk about that, right? And then there were people who did immigration defense for those who got stuck in deportation proceedings. So there was a wide variety of legal and I want to say unpopular challenge to the program. Keep in mind, the program was in effect until just a couple of weeks ago. So during the Obama administration, what he initially did to make the program dormant was to take the countries that were targeted off the list of required registration. And so the program and its infrastructure existed, but there were no countries of origin where people had to register. And so it was effectively dormant. It was just sitting there for a number of years. And so there was a big push by activists in just the last couple of months. I mean, it's been going on for a while, but it heightened during the last couple of months, asking President Obama to dismantle the program. And the hope there was that if he would take it off the books, it would make it more challenging for the Trump administration to resurrect. Now, we got good news about 10 days ago when President Obama and the leadership at the Department of Homeland Security said that they were going to take the program offline, that they were effectively going to end the program. We were really excited about this. It was the culmination of much activism and work led by groups like the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee and another group out of New York called DACY's Rising Up and Moving, or DRUM. We're being pragmatic though, right? So we are, it's like a balance of optimism and pragmatism. This is a really good way for President Obama to end his tenure as president. It sends a really strong message about the problems with the program and where the American people stand on attempting to use it to target members of the Muslim community who are immigrants to our country. At the same time, it's not going to be impossible for Donald Trump to create something similar. It may take a little bit longer than it would have, but it's not going to be impossible in the same way that it wasn't impossible for George W. Bush to create it.
Yeah, does this data exist somewhere at all? It's a matter of just harvesting it, or will they have to create it anew?
So the data exists because everyone that comes in and out of the United States is documented in some way, shape, or form, right? And so for that reason, it wasn't then and it won't be now impossible to do. Anyone that comes in through a checkpoint, citizen or non-citizen, someone's stamping that passport, someone's entering some information in a computer. And something that we've become really hyper aware of and vigilant about is that this information, more so now even than in 2001 and 2002, is shared across agencies. So I know, even as a US citizen, when I come into the country through JFK, through SFO, any questions that I answer, that information gets documented and is often shared with other law enforcement agencies. So we've had clients, for example, unrelated to NSEER, where they will get a call from the FBI and the FBI will say, "We just want to follow up on something that you said at the border when you were coming back from your last trip." And so we're, making sure that people understand that whatever they say to law enforcement is on the record, not just for that agency, but for other agencies as well.
Are you subject to special treatment even though you're a citizen because of your name and appearance?
I fortunately have had generally good experiences. I don't have a very common name. Zahra Bilu is not something that gets confused with a lot of other names. But I do have family, friends, and clients who are US citizens who are detained for sometimes hours and asked absurd and baseless questions about their travels. When we do know your rights presentations, we tell people who are coming through the border who are US citizens that the only thing they're required to answer is information about their identity. And by identity, I mean like their core identity, their name, their citizenship status, right? Very basic things. And then information about their most recent trip, just so that the agents at the border can discern whether or not they've engaged in any illegal activity. But we will get people who report questions like, who paid for your trip? Did you fire a gun while you were there? Which is really, for me, an interesting example, because I think what they're trying to get at is, were you at a terrorist training camp? But you have a right to fire a gun, whether it's at a wedding or a shooting range or at a wedding in celebration, which is something that happens in certain countries.
This is particularly ridiculous in a country where guns are practically sacred objects.
Exactly, right? And so answering that question makes me look suspicious. Like answering that question with "yes, I fired a gun" makes me look suspicious. Saying "no, I didn't fire a gun" if I did is lying to a federal agent, right? And so there are questions like that where we see people put into situations that they really shouldn't be. Are you Sunni or Shia? Where do you live and work in the United States? Now, if I'm a US citizen, it doesn't really matter where I work in the United States. That has nothing to do with my right to enter. And then of course, like people being asked about other people at the border. And the reality here is that when I come back from a 12 or 14-hour flight, I'm tired, I'm fatigued. I just want to go home to my own bed after sitting in a miserable sort of airline seat for a long time. So I may be more willing to answer questions in that circumstance than I would have been otherwise, right? If the FBI had just showed up at my door. And so we're often concerned that these moments of vulnerability are taken advantage of by cooperating law enforcement agencies.
And more broadly, since the election of Donald Trump, how much of an increase in hate crimes and street harassment and just general bad feelings for being Muslim have you and other people experienced?
Yeah, it's been such a difficult 18 months, right? So things have gotten worse in the last 2 months, but keep in mind that there was a 67% increase in hate crimes reported by the FBI, targeting members of the Muslim community and others. There were more attacks on mosques and Muslim organizations in 2015 than any other year, with much of that happening in November and December of last year, right? So many of us, I think, were hoping that we would get a break of sorts after the election, but it hasn't slowed down. In the 10 days following Election Day, there were over 100 incidents that were reported and verified of anti-Muslim attacks, crimes, and attempts at intimidation to care offices across the country in 10 days, right? So that's about 10 a day, when ordinarily we might not get more than 10 or 20 a month. So 111 in 10 days is frightening. But the other thing about that is that's what we verified. So there are incidents that are reported to us often that we can't verify, either because there aren't eyewitnesses, because the person comes forward late, a variety of concerns. So we only put forward what we can verify because we know that when something isn't good data, it undermines every other incident out there, right? So for every fake incident or hoax incident, it can ruin the next 100. Not in our perspective, but in the perspective of members of the alt-right and Trump fans and others who are saying hate crimes don't happen. And so when I say 111, that's just what made the cut for publication.
Is there any geographical pattern to these? Because, you know, people who live in coastal cities think we're somehow exempt from these kinds of things. Is that true?
I wish we were exempt in coastal cities. So of that 111, over 30 were reported in California. And that was sad and frightening for many of us. The thing with any of these numbers, though, is that we get higher numbers where there are better resources to collect data. So California is not immune because we got over 30 verified incidents from California. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that California is worse than Tennessee or Arkansas or some of these other places. It's just that there are 4 care offices in California. There are really large ACLU affiliates in California. There are lots of friendly local law enforcement agencies in California. And so reports will be higher where there are better resources to collect data.
Finally, you touched on this earlier, but it seems like a good thing to close on. Those of us who are not Muslims that are not being targeted, what can we do in the coming months?
Get to know your Muslim neighbors. Make sure that you know your local elected officials, which is something I hadn't said earlier, but progressive elected officials are a minority in this country, at least at the federal level right now. And when we're talking about state and city officials, those are the ones that are going to be best positioned to push back against bad federal policy, right? So in the last few years, we've seen very little move in Congress because of the gridlock. We worry that at this point, even less will move. And so it's going to need to be that cities are declaring themselves sanctuary cities, that local law enforcement agencies are saying we're not going to cooperate with the feds, right? And so get to know your local officials so that you can push them to do the right thing when it comes time. And then be ready, be in touch with local Muslim organizations and civil rights organizations, because whatever comes down, they will need volunteers, they will need funds, they will need people. I don't know that I could say that they will need people to register, but they will need people to protest, sign petitions, and so on.
That was Zahra Ballou, a civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Santa Clara. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, under the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Clampdown by The Clash. Next, Russophobia, which is also spreading like wildfire. As I mentioned in the opening of this interview with Andrew Coburn, liberals on Twitter, some of them with credentials for what that's worth, not just random tweeters, have been arguing over the last few days that Putin is financing and directing secessionist movements in the U.S. As support for this curious claim, one of its adherents posted a link to a Financial Times article from September, which I dutifully read. The article reports on a conference that gathered secessionist movements from around the world to Moscow, held in the shadow of the Kremlin, the headline said, to jack up the sense of intrigue. But since the FT is still a serious paper, the article did have to concede that the whole thing was rather marginal and obscure, featuring among other participants a kung fu instructor who is this self-proclaimed king of Hawaii. At the center of the piece was this remarkable statement: "The scope of the Kremlin's involvement in the movement is unclear. U.S. and EU officials have repeatedly accused Russia of meddling in their elections and funding fringe parties, although evidence of any involvement remains scant." That's what passes for evidence for this crowd. Turning to an outlet far less serious than the Financial Times, the other day Vanity Fair published a piece on its website by its London editor, Henry Porter, with this bracing headline: "Is Putin's master plan only beginning?" The aim of this master plan, you might or might not be surprised to learn, is the destruction of Western democracy. To support this interpretation, Porter summons testimony from Alex Younger, the head of MI6, Britain's equivalent to the CIA. It's remarkable how frequently these outbursts of liberal Russophobia are supported by intelligence agencies, who of course are run by professionals well-schooled in the arts of publicity and not infrequently outright lying. But that's not all. Porter also invokes a bit of nominative determinism so bizarre that I have to quote it. "We are now," Porter wrote, "in an entirely new era in which Putin got away with everything scot-free. Barack Obama stayed his hand after the DNC break-in, and Trump wound up criticizing America's own Foreign Intelligence Service to defend a former KGB agent who, it is no accident, shares the name Vladimir with Lenin." That's the end of the quote from Porter. "It is no accident," funnily enough, is the kind of thing that vulgar Marxists used to say, and that non-vulgar Marxists still say in jest. The mind of the liberal Russophobe is, to paraphrase Hegel, a dark one in which all Vladimirs are revolutionaries. These intellectual pathologies do seem like elaborate but crackpot defensive reactions to Hillary Clinton's loss. The fact that she lost despite getting almost 3 million more votes than the winner, thanks to a holdover from slavery, the Electoral College, seems of less interest to them than spinning elaborate fantasies about Putin's diabolical machinations. Point out that the U.S. interfered in over 80 elections in the 5 decades after World War II, about which few of them breathed a word of criticism, and which their ideological ancestors often celebrated and even participated in the name of the war against communism, and you will be accused of trolling. Point out to them that there's no evidence aside from the word of the CIA that Russians actually hacked Podesta's emails, nor is there any evidence that it made any difference in the election's outcome, and you will be accused of an indifference to an unprecedented assault on our democracy, such as it is. This outburst of Russophobia has a long history going back well over a century. For some amusing visuals, do a Google image search of Russia octopus, and you will see an array of cartoon images of the evil empire using its tentacles to surround the entire Eurasian landmass. We're back in that same territory again. Here's Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, with some analysis of this latest outburst and how it warms the chilly hearts of arms contractors. Andrew Coburn. Liberals, maybe most Democrats, seem to have gone around the bend in their fantasies about Russian manipulation. There's, of course, the interference in the election. But also, I was reading on Twitter the other day that there's a sizable group of people who think that Putin is actively promoting the secession of Russia and Texas from the United States. What do you make of this outbreak of rampant Russophobia?
Well, I think it's it is insane. I mean, it's, you know, it's got various components, one of which is the rather pathetic efforts of the Clintonite Democrats to sort of excuse their shattering defeat by blaming it on Putin, on some outside magical force, which, you know, evil force, which took away their absolutely deserved victory. In fact, you know, we could go into this some other time, but they ran such an inept campaign, they kind of deserved to lose. But beyond that, or behind that, is, you know, the actual need of the sort of the imperative of the military-industrial complex, of the, you know, defense establishment, to have a worthwhile enemy, threat. I mean, ISIS doesn't really hack it because, you know, they're a bunch of grubby fanatics who aren't equipped with heavy weaponry, which would then justify expenditure by us on the same sort of thing. We need a Russia. We've needed one since whenever, 1948. So, and that kind of, you know, there was hard times and the threat of hard times in the 1990s when the threat rather disobligingly sort of disappeared. But we did our best to stoke it back up again by such things as NATO expansion and now we're back in business. So I think that's really the underlying sort of factors that lead to this complete lunacy that we're of the kind you're quoting just now.
But the partisanship of this is curious because, you know, go back to, of course, the origins of the Cold War. The Democrats were very much in the lead on that. The Republicans were had a strong isolationist tendency. But if you look back at the 80s, the Republicans were in the lead on that one with Reagan and his paranoia. And now we have Democrats, and particularly liberal Democrats, really going around the bend on this topic. Do you have any understanding of what's going on just purely in the D.C. sociology of this?
I mean, going back to the 80s again for a second, I mean, or let's talk about the 70s just for a moment. If you remember, it was really Jimmy Carter got the sort of rather undeserved reputation of being a dove and a pathetic wimp who was giving in to the Russians. In fact, it was really what we saw in the Carter years was an attempt to wrest control of the sort of the patronage from the Republicans. I mean, Jimmy Carter, if you remember, cancelled, or rather thought he'd cancelled, the B-1 bomber, and instead had the Democrat bomber, which was the Stealth. And he had the Democrat missile, which was the MX, which went away in the Bush years. So I think, they're both fighting over the same treasure chest. As for the liberals today, I think, as I just said, I think it's some sort of terrible rite of denial to sort of try and pretend that their problems do not stem from the ideological bankruptcy of the party, but as I said, to some sort of magical outside force, some evil demon that caused them to lose. I'm stumped to come up with a definitive answer because it seems so insane the way they're talking that it's hard to find some rational basis for it. But that's my best stab.
There's something weird or uncanny, whatever word you want to use to describe it, about all this, because there's a revival of a whole bunch of old Cold War tropes, but without communists.
Well, yeah, it just showed that communism had not too much to do with it. I mean, it's Russia, you know, it's evil Putin. He might as well be a communist. And, you know, when necessary, we can refer to him as a former KGB officer. I mean, the stuff about the hacking, it's completely demented that somehow, you know, A, that Putin did it, and that what Putin did led to the Democrat defeat, for which there's not a shred of evidence. There's actually pretty much no evidence for Putin having done the hacking in the first place. But even if you accepted that, the easy sort of jump they make to saying, that's why we lost.
Well, of course, we had Paul Krugman, winner of the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Sciences, pointing to some alleged conspiracy between the director of the FBI and Putin, which is just a remarkable assertion for someone of his stature.
I love that. It just showed, I mean, it confirmed what sensible people have thought for a long time, which is Paul Krugman is an idiot. Yeah, that's the best example we've had so far of the unhinged direction this discussion has taken. That, as you said, Paul Krugman alleging Putin and Comey plotting to install Trump, and for whatever reason we don't know.
Well, you know, they're soft on Russia. He wants to do business in Moscow. I don't know. It's all very bizarre. But let's take us back to the 80s. You wrote a book called The Threat on how the Soviet military was nowhere near the ominous machine we made it out to be. So could you just remind us of the reality behind the Soviet threat before we address the Russian threat of today?
Right. I mean, it was said the defense interests in this country had said almost from the beginning that the Russians, or the Soviets, I should say, Sovcoms, were pretty much our equal, and actually are often in many respects our superior militarily, that they had this vast army, superbly trained and equipped. They had an equally vast air force, they had an equally vast nuclear missile force, and really, unless we basically strained every sinew economically to catch up and devoted enormous resources to the military, we were pretty much doomed. And when necessary, they would get into detail that the Russians, specific Russian tank could beat the pants off anything we could put in the field, or ditto, fighter planes and so forth. And needless to say, there was zero evidence for this. take it from the beginning. The Russia was, you know, Soviet Union was completely devastated by World War II. They'd lost between 20 and 30 million people killed. Half the country was in ruins. The Soviet army depended on largely on horse transport until into the 50s, for example. I mean, it was ridiculous to say that they posed any kind of military threat to the US. The famous sort of example of the what I call threat inflation was the missile gap of the 1960 election, when John F. Kennedy campaigned on the presumption that there was a gap, but they had a vastly superior missile force to the United States. Eisenhower got so furious at this that he actually arranged for Kennedy to get an intelligence briefing to demonstrate that no such gap existed. But nevertheless, Kennedy persisted with the lie, because he found it politically useful, through the election. And then, even worse in a way, carried on. So you had a vast buildup of nuclear missiles on both sides. And so they carried on. Carter, you know, ridiculously accepted the proposition that the Russians could destroy all US land-based missiles in a first strike, and so commissioned the MX mobile missile, one of the great boondoggles of all time. There's been very little difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, except in sort of nuance and particular, you know, clients in the military-industrial complex, that, you know, various contractors that they wish to favor. And, you know, there was a bad moment at the end of the Cold War around 1990, when the Soviet Union fell apart and, you know, Russia, the whole place opened up. And then they, you know, there was a brief moment when people had to admit that, though I say it myself, and let's have a pause for self-promotion, what I'd said in my book, The Threat, in the beginning of the 1980s was clear for all to see, you know, that the Soviet army was basically a sort of badly trained, drunken rabble, except for some units, that their weapon systems were, you know, grossly inferior to anything to what we had. But that, you know, didn't last long, and pretty soon, well, certainly by now, we're back to, you know, the Russian giant, you know, that we hear about, the T-15 tank, vastly superior to any whiskered old sort of relic that we can put in the field. They're amazing fighter planes. They're incredibly threatening submarine force. It's all there. It really takes me back 20, 30 years to see the same old rubbish being punted out again in, you know, such sort of house organs as the New York Times and the rest of the mainstream media.
We just got treated to a display of Russian military prowess in Syria. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, the fact was that I wouldn't say the Soviets did anything miraculous in Syria. I mean, they...
Russians, not Soviets. Old habits die hard.
They bombed away. It did make a difference, obviously. I mean, the U.S. and its, you know, its allies like Saudi Arabia had been carrying on the presumption that they would face no significant, you know, opposition, and certainly no opposition in the air. And suddenly the Russians turn up and you know, did make a difference. But I, you know, I can't see that they've done anything amazingly ingenious or technologically brilliant. They just sort of showed up, you know. So needless to say, it's going to be used, or is being used already, as justification for further, you know, further expenditure on our part.
Trump seems insufficiently alarmed by the Russian threat from the point of view of the military-industrial complex. How can they raise his alarm level?
If I were a defense contractor, I wouldn't be too worried. I mean, he said he's going to expand the military anyway. He said he's going to expand nuclear forces, which has caused some alarms, because he said it in a sort of particularly bombastic way. Actually, as far as I can see, he's not going to do anything that Obama hasn't already been doing. So I think, although he has this, you know, actually rather very sensible remarks about perhaps, you know, having proper negotiations with the Russians and not sort of treating them to hysterical demonization, such as Clinton was indulging in, and her, you know, the shattered remains of the Democratic Party, as we discussed earlier, were talking about. But I feel, in fact, I fear that Trump's one sensible policy, which is his attitude toward Russia, will be sort of chipped away, you know, the defense industry won't let him get away with this for too long. And I think, and, you know, business will continue as normal. I mean, he's actually already promised that, as I said, with nuclear, you know, defense build up all around. But as I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, you need a threat. You can't do it in a vacuum for too long. And that's what we'll have.
I'm speaking with Andrew Coburn, who's the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. So let's look at it from the other side for a moment. You mentioned NATO expansion, but the U.S. has done plenty in recent years to stoke Russian paranoia too, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, starting with NATO expansion, which was, you know, the as the Russians keep complaining, and as far as I can find out, quite justifiably, that the promise for Russia, the Soviets, or, you know, Gorbachev in the dying days of the Soviet Union, for pulling out of Eastern Europe was that NATO would not expand eastwards. You know, James Baker, Secretary of State, said in whenever it was, 1901, not an inch to the east. And we promptly broke that promise. Bill Clinton explicitly broke that promise for various reasons, including the fact that Zbigniew Brzezinski said he would lose the Polish vote in Milwaukee or adjacent place if he didn't do it. So Clinton, you know, whose entire political record has been one of betrayal, broke that promise. And egged on, I might say, by particularly the Lockheed Corporation, which rightly saw an opportunity to sell F-16s in Eastern Europe, many billions of dollars worth. You know, it was a very disgraceful scene in the 1990s as arms salesmen from the U.S. flocked into Eastern Europe to sell these countries, which at the time were completely bankrupt, you know, to foist weapon systems on them under the guy, you know, telling them this is what you have to do to be in NATO. I mean, there was a particularly disgraceful episode I remember looking at where they were selling, the Bell Corporation was selling helicopters to Romania at the time there was no running water in the Romanian hospitals, in the Bucharest hospitals. I mean, it was absolutely loathsome what they did. Anyway, this did have the effect of sort of getting the Cold War more or less, you know, to be back in business. Beyond that, I mean, the other thing that's happened, of course, is the U.S. behaving for many years as if, you know, it had no competitor. That, you know, that's why what's happened in Syria has been a nasty shock, because, you know, it did what it wanted in Iraq, did what it wanted in Libya. Sort of Russians felt fooled by that. They were fooled into supporting a UN resolution authorizing the Libyan operation. And it was doing more or less what it wanted in Syria. And then suddenly the Russians say, wait a minute, you know, we're going to put a stop to this. And, you know, sent actually a rather limited force to Syria, which had the effect of destroying the Obama policy of regime change. So it's, you know, we've done our best to get the Cold War going again quite successfully.
People seem to forget that Obama himself was proposing a trillion-dollar modernization, as the publicists like to call it, of our nuclear weapons stocks.
Right. I mean, Trump says, I'm going to expend our nuclear forces until the rest of the world comes to his senses and all the liberals denounce him. But he's not doing anything that Obama hasn't already set in motion. I mean, that was, again, you know, the imperative for that was a sort of need for business on the part of, you know, Lockheed's and Boeing's and Northrop's and all those other characters. The actual justification for Obama was, you know, he'd got himself an arms control treaty, the START, New START, which enjoined a pretty limited reduction of nuclear forces, of nuclear warheads, not very significant ones. But to get this foreign policy triumph through the Senate, he needed the cooperation of Senate Republicans, who demanded, who gave voice to the demands of the defense corporations for, you know, a wholesale modernization of our nuclear forces, new bomber, new ICBM, new bombs, new actual nuclear bombs. There's a whole new family of nuclear warheads being designed, produced, new submarines, new submarine missiles, and so forth. And so that was the, you know, that's what Obama blithely signed off on, which, as you said, is, you know, reliably estimated, it's going to cost us $1 trillion over the years to come.
We also have Trump now tweeting scandalously about cost overruns. First, there was Air Force One, and then there was a fighter plane whose moniker I can't remember. What are they going to do about this threat? I imagine lobbyists are already being mobilized, but how do you think they're going to manage this indiscretion?
Well, it's an easy mark. I mean, everyone, you know, the people aren't dumb. They know that these, you know, the defense budget is largely a matter of ripoff. So Trump can make himself look good. I would be very, very surprised if anything significant happens to the F-35 program and the other one he went after, the Air Force One program, and he's had the contractors in to sort of be given a spanking, the Lockheed CEO and the Boeing CEO, and they pledged to drive costs down. I mean, it's pretty easy to, you know, they're so good at fiddling the books, they can make it look as if they've cut costs, where they, you know, the reality will be something different. I mean, the total cost of the F-35 program, when you estimate, you know, what it's going to cost in the future, a lot of that depends on your estimate, or rather guesstimate, of what inflation would be. And the Pentagon has its own inflation indicator, their own inflation calculation equation. So they could say, whoops, you know, we've recalculated things and it's going to cost a few hundred million dollars less. It's all make-believe. I mean, the more important thing is Trump should simply, since the F-35 is a complete dog which breaks down, you know, can barely fly half the time and certainly can't fly when there's a thunderstorm anywhere within 25 miles, because it's liable to explode, and a whole host of other deficiencies, he should just cancel it outright. But that's quite certainly not going to happen.
And Trump, of course, will be able to claim credit as a brilliant manager by driving down costs.
Yes. That's exactly what will happen. In that addled brain, where, you know, he comes up with some quite sensible remarks, like, as he said, he doesn't need a $4 billion airplane to fly around in. I think he's comparing that with the plane he currently flies around in, which I think costs $10 million, which is some very aged plane he bought from a Danish charter company, which he finds perfectly satisfactory. He can't see why they want to foist this $4 billion thing on him.
And all the KFC you can eat, too, of course. So, in conclusion, what can we look forward to in the coming years? More of this Russian threat inflation? It's already getting pretty old, but I guess we're going to face lots more of it.
I think so. It depends how long they take to whittle, get Trump off this rather irritating position he has of making nice with Putin. And of course, you know, the secession of Putin organized secession of California and Texas, as you mentioned earlier, perhaps. You know, things will carry. I think we'll hear ongoing hysteria from the Democrats. I think they've already, you know, the sort of war party in the Senate, I mean, McCain and Lindsey Graham already agreed to a joint inquiry into Russian interference in the election. So I think it'll simmer away. The defense budget will go up. The economy will suffer, and life will be pretty much normal.
That was Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's. His 1983 book, The Threat, was a masterful refutation of the early Reagan-era paranoia about the Soviet military. It's depressing that we're back in similar territory 33 years later. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I don't know about you, but among my circle of friends, people are seriously on edge about the coming year. I'm certainly among them. So I thought I'd end the last show of 2016 with some profound musical inspiration, the conclusion of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Some people find this version to be overly cerebral, chilly even, but I find it glorious. This is a lot longer than the usual musical clips on Behind the News, but I just feel the need for some kind of inspiration that out of the ordinary. Mahler certainly draws on Christian themes of resurrection here, but it's not explicitly religious, which is also a comfort to my secular mind. Happy New Year. Till next week. Bye.